Meanwhile, the Bulls will be looking for their first win when they play Dallas on the road tonight. In the NFL, the Bears came up literally a yard short yesterday in their 38-31 loss to the Patriots. On the final play of the game, Kevin White got stopped at the one-yard line after hauling in a 54-yard pass. In the NHL, Tampa Bay beat the Blackhawks 6-3. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunny today, a high of 60. That's 3 degrees warmer than normal for this time of year. A west wind at 5 to 10. Clear skies tonight for the most part. A low around 35. Then for tomorrow, more sunshine, but markedly cooler. A high tomorrow of 50. Expanded forecast, dry Wednesday and Thursday. Not much change in temperature. Right now, sunshine and 38. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Gregory Berg is coming up.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2018. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Support for the morning show also comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Lenora Chu, we welcome you to the morning show. Thank you. In part one of today's program, we're hearing from a woman by the name of Lenora Chu, who tells the intriguing story of what it feels like when one puts your son into one of the most prestigious elementary schools in all of China, a school that has very, very different practices from those that we are accustomed to here in the United States. Lenora Chu tells this story in a remarkable book called Little Soldiers, An American Boy, a Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve. Lenora Chu, we welcome you to the morning show. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So explain to our listeners the circumstances under which you and your husband and young son found yourselves in China, and just how dramatic a moment, in a sense, this was in your family's life. Or was it just one more chapter of living in one more exotic and exciting place?
Sure. Well, we moved from California to Shanghai, China, back in 2010. And if you remember that year, it's hard to believe now, but the economy in the U.S. was not doing well. We were sort of in the trough of the recession, coming out of it a little bit. But China, by comparison, seemed like it was doing really well. And then in education, it was doing really, really well. It sort of came in number one in the world on this test called PISA out of the OECD in math, reading, and science. So we had basically left the U.S. and landed into Shanghai, China's trophy city, which happened to produce the world's best students, if you believe that sort of thing. And we had a little boy. So the story kind of begins when we enroll him in a local Chinese school just down the street.
And you are very, very happy that you are able to do this, because this is, in a sense, a really prized slot. I mean, there are not many available openings. In fact, just briefly tell our listeners just sort of the arduous gauntlet you and your husband underwent, how many times you had to ask before finally a spot apparently was open for your son.
Oh, sure. Phone calls, you know, walking by, trying to get a glimpse. There's a guard at the gate, you know, and of course the school is beautiful from the outside. We could never get in. So we really had to call, stop by, ask friends to write letters for us. We did all kinds of things, but we finally got an interview.
So what was intriguing about this is that, in a sense, you were unable, really forbidden, from viewing the actual educational process in the classrooms of this school. Explain just how secretive a place it was in that respect.
Sure. You know, schools here in China, they're state-run institutions. You know, this is the Chinese government, and it's not really something that allows for the casual observer. Not only that, it's a very authoritarian culture when it comes to government, when it comes to schools. And so when you have this American sort of coming around and saying, hey, I don't like the way you do this, I noticed this that I didn't like, you know, they tried to put the kibosh on that really fast. That, of course, made me more curious.
Well, explain some of what your young son Rainey would sort of do and say and demonstrate at home that began to sort of fire up your sense of parental concern that perhaps some things were happening in that classroom that were not exactly to your liking.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he was forced to eat an egg, which he hates eggs. You know, I could never get him to eat it. And so all of a sudden, his teacher had, you know, gotten him to eat this thing that he'd hated for the first 3 years of his life. You know, there were other things, like he was learning Chinese songs with, you know, a political tint that sort of raised my red flags. You know, I don't want to say that I didn't know this was going to be part of his experience, you know, but it's very different, actually. It's very different. Let me start over. You know, he was forced to eat an egg the very first week of school, which I did not like, because as someone who believes kids shouldn't be forced to do something they don't want to do, this sort of offended, I guess if you would want to call it, my sort of democratic sensibilities. Other things like learning Chinese songs are fine. That's what we want. We want him to speak Mandarin, but not when there's, you know, a political tint to it. You know, and the whole process of adjusting to having a child in Chinese school was really just, what can I live with? What am I comfortable with? And then on the flip side, what might he actually benefit from? And I really had to spend the next couple of years teasing out what was good, what was bad, and what was, in my opinion, ugly.
One of the most dramatic differences between your young son and his classmates has to do with sort of the whole familial hierarchy in China that you really spell out for us. That, for instance, when there's something like Grandparents' Day at school, that nearly every single child would have all four grandparents there. And all four grandparents, along with the parents, would be involved in the parenting and the raising of a child. And for you and your young son, it was a very, very different scenario, and that was just one of many ways in which your son Rainey stood out from his classmates in ways that sometimes made him very uncomfortable and awkward.
Yeah, I mean, there was also the fact that his Chinese teacher would call him, you know, little foreigner. He was one of, you know, he really stood out in many, many ways. Another way, like you said, he didn't have any grandparents in town. He only had me. So there were constant daily reminders that, you know, he was an American in a Chinese school, not only because of his nationality, but also culturally. And you know, in some sense, that made this narrative, you know, conflict makes for a good story, right? And how do you, as a human being and as a parent, deal with this conflict? I'm sure some people would have gone running for the hills.
As you observe the teaching that went on in another school called Harmony Kindergarten, I mean, there you mm-hmm. were permitted to actually view what was going on. You observed one moment that I thought was especially fascinating. It was a moment when these children were being lined up and one by one dismissed. And as far as you could tell, the decision about which child is dismissed next would have nothing to do with how still they were standing. They were all standing perfectly still as they were supposed to, hands to themselves and so on. But it was, it appeared to be completely arbitrary. And after watching this for a while, you said, I understood then, before long, that arbitrariness was the point, and identified the exercise for what it was, a demonstration of who was in charge. And it sounds like both at this school you visited and at the school that your little boy was attending, that this was of paramount importance.
Teacher knows best. I mean, that's the number one lesson when you are in this Chinese school system. Teacher knows best, administrators know best. And, you know, after seeing a few warning signals, you know, with my son's school, I tried to get in for an observation, and of course I was denied. So then I do what journalists do, which is ask questions, find other people to talk to. And I eventually, as you said, had gotten into this other kindergarten. And what I saw was somewhat shocking. You had the teacher marching around, screaming at our children. These are three-year-olds on their first day of preschool, being planted forcibly into chairs, being asked to draw rain in exactly one fashion, which is from the top to the bottom of the page and from the right to the left. You know, this was an authoritarian classroom, and I realized before long exactly what my son probably was dealing with. Now, I have to say, the book then goes into this narrative, you know, where is China trying to change? And to be fair, you know, people in China, they travel now, they travel widely, especially in Shanghai and Beijing. They've been outward looking in education for quite some time, and they understand that the top-down authoritarian classroom isn't necessarily good for the child. So they are trying to reform some of these things, but perhaps not fast enough.
Right, not fast enough to suit you, certainly.
right, sure. It depends. It depends on what kind of classroom you're in.
So. Right, absolutely. I want to make sure to give you a chance to talk about the way in which you and your husband have chosen to live in China. Quite different from many foreigners, you say, who live in modern Shanghai, brought there by various firms. You say, in other words, many of these people try to insulate themselves from the experience of China as much as they possibly could. And you and your husband, Rob, wanted to be another type of foreigner in China altogether. So how have you tried to live in China that would be different from the experience of many, many others to whom you're referring there in that passage?
It just seemed to me, in a lot of ways, it would be a shame if we didn't have Chinese friends, if my son also did not learn to speak Mandarin. You know, it's not like I thought about going local, you know, but it just, we're here, and there are people in the U.S. who pay plenty of money to have a Mandarin-speaking nanny, and Chinese immersion schools are now becoming popular. And we're in Shanghai. And not only that, it's, you know, reputed to have some of the best schools in the country. I just wanted to experience this culture in a way that wasn't so insular, you know, in a way that I've seen other foreigners do it. So that was our goal. Mm. Why not?
Mm-hmm. One danger of living in a place like Shanghai is the quality of the air. The pollution there mm-hmm. is quite serious, and it sounds like your son Rainey has contended with asthma. And first of all, explain to our listeners how you would know just from kind of looking at something in the neighborhood that that was a good day or a not good day in terms of air quality in your city, and the concerns that that came up when it came to the matter of medication at your son's school.
Oh, sure. You know, in the wintertime, the weather patterns are such that sometimes it gets very polluted. And, you know, people who live here who are concerned about air quality, we have monitors in our house, we have air filters. And oftentimes I could tell how good the air was by looking out the window. And if I can see Jing'an Temple, which is this sort of historic monument in Shanghai, if I can actually see it outside my window, it's about a mile away. That means it's a good day. But many times in December, you can't see it at all, you know, and that means they are so polluted, you really, you know, some days you couldn't even see your hand in front of your face. That's rarer. It's getting more and more rare. But there was a time back in 2013, 2014, where it was incredibly polluted. They called it airpocalypse. And that was what we were dealing with, you know, living here in Shanghai. My son, he's outgrown it now, but at the time he was dealing with some early onset asthma, I guess if you could call it that, and tried to get the teacher to make some accommodations for him. But of course, she basically said, we don't do that. You know, it's the rights of the group over the rights of the individual. And I think that is one defining difference in the culture here.
Right. So for instance, you were really concerned that Rainey's asthma medication, which he might have a very acute need of at some point, if it's stored in the nurse's office, that is far away from the classroom and too far away for your comfort. But they were not willing to store that asthma medication even safely in a drawer. Right.
Yeah. The point was, you know, the medication needs, in an emergency situation, you need to be close enough to be able to access it. But, you know, the point of that story, they said, no, you know, we have our rules and they cannot be bent. And the point of the story is they just don't make accommodations for people. You know, they don't make accommodations for the individual. And really, I came away thinking, huh, you know, am I going to deal with the system as it's delivered to me, or am I going to pull out, or am I going to try to fight? And it was these moments that I was having really throughout the narrative. And in examining some of these conflicts, you understand China a bit better. Right? I mean, if they're making accommodations for, say, every one of those 35 kids in the classroom, the teacher was going to spend, you know, more time making accommodations than teaching. And that was her point when she replied to me, you know, in the way that she did. So
I thought an especially interesting chapter was the chapter called No Rewards for Second Place, which delves into the whole matter of competition and the way in which the ranking of children is handled very, very differently in China than it tends to be here in America, where you write, Americans generally hold a child's regard for self and emotional evaluation of one's own worth with feather-soft gloves, as if it were a panda cub, which requires special care because it is blind at birth and immobile and unable to feed itself. A child's self-esteem is treated almost as a physical organ, nearly as important as the beating heart. And, of course, towards that end, in many situations, you find these scenarios in which every child who participates gets a trophy, even if they finish last and so on. I mean, just trying to be so careful with people, with young children's feelings and their self-esteem and so on. Not so in China. You call the approach in China much more utilitarian. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about and the way in which rankings were part of everything and handled in such straightforward fashion.
Yeah, you know, self-esteem isn't really something that they talk about a lot in this culture. You know, a grade is a grade, a score is a score. A kid is either fast or they're not. They score well in math or they don't. You know, the Chinese that I know are not worried about how, you know, little Ming will feel if he gets a 67 in math. And part of that is because I found in my research that they really believe in this connection between effort and results. Effort and results, right? You work hard in math or in sports or whatever it is, and you get results. What I found a study actually that showed that most Americans actually believe the opposite. They believe in talent and results. And what that means is that kids, we've lost the emphasis on hard work in the classroom in the U.S. by comparison, right? You're looking at a kid who's six and thinking, oh, they might not have the genetics to do math, instead of looking at that kid and saying, oh, if he works hard, he's going to get his multiplication tables. And to me, that all relates to self-esteem. When we think about talent and its connection to academics, we're actually giving up on a whole host of kids who might actually learn something with a little bit of work. So, you know, that is a big difference in the culture. And by worrying too much about self-esteem, we're actually letting up on the gas pedal in the classroom in the U.S. in some sense, because we just don't believe every kid can get it. And not only that, if they don't get it, it's not their fault, so let's not make them feel bad about it. That's where the self-esteem argument can become so damaging, I think.
Interesting.
Over there in our culture, yeah.
Right. So one of the things that is most interesting about your book, Little Soldiers, is that it is so interesting for you to sort of chart the experience of your young son, Rainey, and the way in which his attitudes really change about school and about China, about living in China. Without giving too much away, there's kind of a dramatic moment in the second section of the book when your little boy one day just announces, I like China better than the United States. He's just kind of arrived at that choice. And one thinks back to earlier in the book when over and over again he would tell you how much he hated school. Just talk for a moment about, in a sense, kind of the interesting journey that your young boy, Rainey, took, and how, in a sense, disconcerting it was to not always know all that much about what was causing some of these changes in his attitude.
You know, it's funny. Now he's completely opposite. I mean, he's very well aware that he's American, and that is the culture where he feels most comfortable. It makes sense. He is American. You know, it's really hard to assimilate fully into Chinese culture. You're always going to be the foreigner. And we spend a lot of time in the U.S. during the summertime. We still live in Shanghai now. That's where we're conducting this interview. But when we spend time in the U.S., it's just he feels more comfortable there. He feels more comfortable speaking English. He plays a lot of sports. He's on the baseball team. He's on the soccer team. And so it's very clear in his mind now, especially as he's approaching 10 years old, you know, which country is his own. But early on, when he was 3, when he was 4, when he was 5, you know, as he was learning the Chinese language, there was all this other stuff that came with it, this nationalism that comes into the classroom. And, you know, it was something that we really had to talk to him about.
One of the striking moments in the book is when you are first back in the United States, I think on summer break. And it was when you were back in America that, in a sense, you began to kind of, you were in a position to assess young Rainey's progress and the way in which he related to his peers in the United States. And maybe we're beginning to see, in a sense, maybe some of the hallmarks of the education that he was receiving. Just talk for a moment about how interesting it was for you to see your son in America with other American children of his age.
Sure. It's true. You know, well, at that young age, you know, when I wrote that scene, he was 5 or 6 years old, he was pretty well behaved, and he knew to say hello to his elders. You know, when he came down to the breakfast table, if we're visiting somebody, he knew that teachers were to be respected. He knew he was to pack his own backpack for school. all these little behaviors that they emphasize in China, that education is important, that, you know, respecting your elders is important. I was perfectly happy that he learned these lessons. You know, it's not something I had to teach him. I don't think that's really part of the American lexicon anymore, you know, respecting your teachers, taking responsibility for your own school books. I mean, I think I'm sort of generalizing here, but, you know, we have lost a little bit of that respect for education. You know, the research studies show that. And I love that he's absorbed that from his time here in China. The other thing is, now that he's approaching 10, he's doing math at a very high level. That's another thing the Chinese school system does really well, is the way that they teach math. You know, primary school teachers, math teachers in China teach only math, whereas in the U.S., you'll have a first grade teacher teaching not only math, but art and English and pretty much everything else. We expect our American teachers to be generalists, but in China, they specialize from a very early age, and I think there are benefits to that. So some of these things I think that he has benefited from, and hopefully they stay with him.
Hmm. I know that one of the things that concerned you the most was the way in which the typical classroom in China promotes conformity more than what we think of as creativity. And you describe a scene, I think this is when you're visiting a Harmony Kindergarten, and you have a room full of children that are supposed to be drawing pictures of rain. And the whole point of this exercise is to make the raindrops look exactly the same, exactly like raindrops. And, you know, there's to be no experimentation. I mean, the only artwork that is praised are the ones that are just meticulous and exactly what we sort of expect raindrops to look like. And that, and you sort of bridled against that notion that that kind of an exercise should be about, in a sense, coloring perfectly within the lines and doing exactly what is expected. I mean, it runs counter to what we think of as what creativity is all about. And yet, I get the sense from reading your book that you began to see that even in a scenario where conformity is so prized, that in many cases, children would find small, subtle ways to be creative. I mean, and to express themselves as individuals, and perhaps in a really strange, unexpected way, maybe creativity was being fostered in a very effective way, that it might actually not be in some freewheeling space where anything goes and do whatever you want to do. I mean, you know, that yes, that's creative, but maybe not creative, maybe in quite as meaningful a way, or I'm not sure, but it certainly seems like it challenged some of your notions about what creativity is and how one fosters it.
Sure. You know, what I found is, I've given book talks in maybe 15, 16 American cities now, also here in China, in Australia, New Zealand, and I've noticed that people always say the Chinese have no creativity. They're not creative. They're rote learning robots. I hear that a lot. But then when you ask people to define what creativity is, they often can't answer. And there is actually a definition. The creative process is one in which you come up with something original that also has value. So it's not about just doing something a different way. It actually has to have value. In other words, it has to advance the conversation, you know, advance your understanding in some way. You know, our paragon of creative innovation is Steve Jobs. You know, he created products that pretty much upended industries as we know it, right? That is the definition. Original and also has value. But here's the thing. The Chinese, you can actually break that down into three components. You actually have to have knowledge to be able to do that. You know, in America, we overemphasize the original thinking part, the think different, the Apple slogan, you know, doing something differently. And we all talk about Steve Jobs as the college dropout. He did it so differently. Isn't he bold? But we forget he actually had a lot of knowledge when it comes to electronics, computers, and that sort of thing. And so when you look at the Chinese, I believe it's fair to say that they have a huge focus on the knowledge portion of education. They're not as good as encouraging kids to be original and to challenge the norm. But on the flip side, American culture, we very much emphasize the outside-the-box thinking, But hey, you know what? Maybe we're getting a little bit too far away from knowledge, imparting knowledge in the classroom, and the importance of expertise in a particular domain. So it's, you know, just another way of looking at creativity. You could say that the Chinese kind of come at it from the other direction. You know, knowledge first and original thinking later. And we in America overemphasize the original thinking, the outside-the-box thinking. So it's not that there is no creativity. It's just that they slice it differently here in China. They're working pretty hard on the areas in which they're deficient.
Right. To finish up.
Does that make any sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I really appreciate the fact that you are bringing to light sort of the complexity of it. And I think creativity is something that we tend to be, in a sense, really sloppy about, mm-hmm. and careless about in terms of defining exactly what it is, and certainly in understanding what fosters it and nurtures
it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
To finish out, I wonder if you would just say a word about just the nation of China itself and some of the challenges that its people are facing, and in particular, the young people, the kind of challenges that they are facing in this sort of highly competitive landscape, desperate for opportunities and desperate for them, in a sense, from a very, very early age. I mean, what kind of toll does that take emotionally and mentally?
You know, the truth is there are nearly 500,000 Chinese coming to the U.S. every year for schooling, and most people still believe the ultimate, you know, educational experience is to head abroad for some part of it, right? That's changing and starting to change, but for the most part, still, most Chinese with means and resources are going to go abroad for part of their education, and oftentimes they look to the U.S. I think the challenge, you know, growing up in China is, it depends on who you are. There's so much inequality here that doesn't get talked about. If you're growing up in rural Hunan province, one of the poorest provinces in China, there's still a lot of poverty here, but you don't hear about that. And if you're one of those kids versus someone in Shanghai, there's a huge gap that you have to contend with. There's a lot of inequality in the system. And also, it's really test-focused. You know, in the upper years, all you're doing is studying for tests, and that's extremely taxing for these kids too. So in all, I think that we are very lucky in the U.S. to have choices. I'm not to say that there isn't, you know, crippling inequality in the system there too, but for the most part, you know, we educate most children. We pretend that we educate all children. And in China, you have half of these kids dropping out of the normal school system by the time high school comes around. So that there's a lot of problems that China still has to deal with in education. Hmm.
Well, it is so great to read a book like yours in which you give us your very interesting perspective as an American living there, as a concerned mother wanting to see to it that your child receives the very best educational experience that is possible. And of course, again and again, I think one of the things that makes your book especially interesting and endearing is that you're very honest about, in mm-hmm. a sense, your own awkwardness. The fact that, you and your husband willingly, enthusiastically enrolled your son in this important school, and then you turn right around and question its methods and challenge its teachers and so on in a way that they do not appreciate. And I just like the way in which you kind of share these experiences and describe them to us with such honesty and not with, in a sense, the wrong kind of self-righteousness. I mean, you're kind of struggling and grappling and learning along with everybody else in this scenario. And I want to compliment you for telling the story in that way.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for reading.
It's a great book.
I hope everybody learns a little bit more about, you know, education in China. And, you know, China is an important country. It's 1.3 billion people. we're now in a trade war. The U.S. and China are now, embarked in a trade war. What are the Chinese thinking? What is the culture about? Why does Xi Jinping, the leader of the Communist Party, why does he behave the way that he does? And you'll learn all of these things by reading Little Soldiers, because it all starts with education, right? What happens in the classroom? So thanks for this opportunity.
You're very welcome. I want to remind our listeners, the book is Little Soldiers, An American Boy, A Chinese School, and the Global Race to Achieve, available now in paperback from Harper. Lenora Chu, thank you so much for writing this wonderful book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you and your family.
Thanks so much. Cheers.
The time is 8:45, and you're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. My next morning show guest is Sahara Rose Katabi, and she has put together a beautiful book which introduces us to what she calls the world's most ancient health system. And it is something that emerged from the nation of India over 5,000 years ago, Ayurveda. And it is something that has made a huge difference for the better in her own life and health. And she has taken some of these ancient practices and tried to give them, in a sense, a modern twist, a modern perspective. And she introduces all of this in a lovely new book called Eat, Feel Fresh, a contemporary plant-based Ayurvedic cookbook. And we have Sahara Rose Katabi with us to talk about this this new book and all that she has done in this particular movement. Sahara Rose Katabi, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you really take care to explain to us that this term Ayurveda is not a diet. It is something bigger than that. You call it a health system, and a very, very old one, which in some respects has some connotation with the much better known term yoga. Explain what Ayurveda is, and also its relationship to yoga, which I'm sure many of our listeners have heard of.
Yeah, so Ayurveda is the ancient Indian health system that is the sister science of yoga. So yoga that we practice for physical or mental reasons, if you're going to a yoga class to deal with your anxiety or to get more flexible, really, it's Ayurveda that you're practicing. So the word Ayurveda means the knowledge of life, and it is essentially the predecessor of yoga. It is the balance of your mind and your body, so you can practice yoga, which is really a spiritual practice. So Ayurveda has to do with nutrition, diet, self-care, philosophy, spirituality. Anything related to balancing the mind and body is related to Ayurveda, and yoga is a spiritual practice.
One of the things that is interesting is how you use the word science to describe Ayurveda. And I don't think you're using science exactly in the way that we sometimes think of as modern science, but you use that term more than once. How are you using the term science as it specifically relates to Ayurveda?
Yeah, so Ayurveda actually is a science. It's actually where surgery comes from, herbology comes from, Chinese medicine, Western medicine, all has roots in Ayurveda. They were the first people ever to see that plants are truly contain different phytonutrients that can heal off different diseases. So when you go to India and you visit an Ayurvedic doctor, they've undergone just as extensive medical training as a Western doctor. So it really is a science. But this science is not just one that is shown in labs. It's not one that uses chemicals to replace ingredients with. It is one that looks at nature for our solutions.
One of the things you tell us about Ayurveda is that from a very early point in history, those who practiced it and in a sense created it were very much concerned with digestion. And it's really interesting to think about people thousands of years ago being aware of and thinking about digestion very specifically. Explain how digestion itself has been a hallmark of Ayurvedic practices over the centuries.
Yes. In Ayurveda, they say it's not you are what you eat, but you are what you digest. So digestion is really the cornerstone of all health. Digestion is what allows us to take those delicious kale smoothies and superfood salads that we eat and actually turn them into nourishment for the body. So if you're not digesting something, not only are you not using all of the nutrients that it has, you're actually creating toxins in your system. So it's so important that we have a healthy and strong digestion, because as we know, when our digestive system is out of whack, we don't feel as happy. And we now know from studies that 95% of our serotonin, our happiness hormone, is stored in our gut. So having a healthy digestion is the key to a healthy and balanced mind.
You also use a term that I think a lot of us have seen, but that we don't maybe necessarily understand, particularly as it relates to the food we take into our bodies. Talk about the term alkaline and a difference it makes in terms of what kind of food we choose to make the cornerstone of our diet.
Yes. So foods can either make us more alkaline or more acidic. And most of us in today's Western culture are more acidic because we're eating a lot of refined, processed, saturated, chemical, sugar, junk foods, essentially. So these foods are going to make our bodies more acidic, which makes them more prone to diseases. Diseases can actually only thrive in an acidic environment. So alkaline foods are fruits, they're vegetables, they're foods that naturally grow from the earth. And the more alkaline our body, the better able we are to combat diseases and be productive and really fulfill our purposes here on this planet.
Mm. So explain how you have taken some of these ancient practices of Ayurveda and made them, in a sense, more modern when it comes to making specific choices about food. In what way have you maybe slightly altered or refined some of the more ancient ideas about diet within this Ayurvedic system?
Yes. So in ancient India, they obviously did not have refrigerators. So for them, they said, don't eat food that was cooked more than 3 hours ago. And that made total sense in that time, because if food was left out in 120-degree India, it would have gone bad. But now we have refrigeration, we have containers that we can safely store our meals in. So I believe meal prep is something that we all can really benefit from. Most of us are not home, and we can create a meal that can last us for the next 2 to 3 days to lessen our cooking time. I've also made it plant-based. So traditionally, Ayurveda contains a lot of dairy products because they knew they needed a healthy fat, but they didn't have access to avocados and oil distillation processes. So for them, they had cows going around everywhere. So to use the milk of that cow and then use the ghee, which is the clarified butter of that cow, was their form of healthy fat. And that was the best option they had at this time. But now we have coconut oil, sesame oil, avocado, flax seeds, hemp seeds, all of these other incredible choices that we can replace the dairy products with. And with all of the factory farming and the different hormones going into our milk, I think it's better that we shift towards a more plant-based style of living.
Hmm. I'd love to have you outline a couple of important hallmarks of your book. And one of them is that you outline the six tastes of Ayurveda. Explain what these six tastes are and why it is important to keep these in mind as one sort of constructs whatever sort of personal diet you would want to draw from this.
Yes. The six tastes of Ayurveda are sweet, sour, salty, bitter, pungent, and astringent. So these tastes will essentially balance out your nutritional needs so you no longer crave foods. So the reason why lots of us go on a diet and then a week later are dreaming about brownies and cake and cookies and bread is because we cut out the sweet taste. So our body is naturally wanting something sweet, so it goes to the most over-the-top form, which is pure sugar, whereas if we had been consuming something like a sweet potato, we would have not had that same craving. So eating these six tastes every day is a really easy way of making sure you're getting all of the nutrients that you need without having to count calories and really looking at food as a number, which is what we've been trained to do, what I was trained to do in my sports nutrition, you know, certification. But food is something that is meant to be enjoyed, and we're supposed to have these six tastes every day, and that's why they each contain different nutritional properties.
Hmm. Your book goes on to outline all kinds of interesting information, including 11 tenets for health, some of which people will recognize, and others will be probably new to them. You outline what's important to have on your spice rack, ways to use onion and garlic in wonderful and interesting ways, basics on how to prepare important sauces and other condiments, and of course a whole host of amazing recipes. How usable are the recipes for the typical American? I mean, is the typical American using this book going to be able to find the ingredients that are outlined in so many of these intriguing recipes?
Yes, and that is exactly who I created this book for. I wanted someone to walk into your regular grocery store and be able to find all of the ingredients needed for a recipe. So they're delicious, they're healthy, they're affordable, and they're accessible. I use things like oats, sweet potatoes, different vegetables you can find at your local farmer's market, things that are available and accessible to every single person, because you don't need to go order a whole new rack of spices that you use once and never use again. And it's all about integrating them little by little, taking something that you love, like a pizza or a Southwestern salad, and how can you use more, maybe throw in some cumin in there, throw in some ginger in there, so you're not, you know, trying this new diet and giving it up, which we've all done too many times in the past, but you're able to take the foods that you're eating on a daily basis, the ingredients you're familiar with that your family already loves and is easily able to afford, and upgrading that.
Mm. Well, it's an amazing book, and there are all kinds of intriguing recipes in here of every facet of a typical meal, from marvelous-looking smoothies to incredible salads and much, much more. And beautiful full-color illustrations as well. The book is published by Alpha. Again, it's titled Eat, Feel Fresh. The author, Sahara Rose Khatabi. Sahara Rose Khatabi, thank you so much for joining me on The Morning Show, and best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me, Greg.
You're welcome. And now it's time to talk about some of the morning show interviews that are coming up for the remainder of the week. Tomorrow on the program, I am happy to welcome back to the morning show writer Parker J. Palmer, whose latest book is a very personal book about the later years of life. It's called On the Brink of Everything: Grace, Gravity, and Getting Old. Parker J. Palmer is in his early 80s and looking at life a bit differently than he once did. And in this very thoughtfully written book, he gives us a lot to think about in terms of the meaning of life and from what we derive our deepest meaning, and what it means to reach that point of life when so much of life is behind us rather than ahead of us. He's a very fine writer, and I'm excited to share this interview with him on tomorrow's morning show. On Wednesday, I'll be welcoming back into our studios Dr. Art Sear, Clawson Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business, who pays a monthly visit to the morning show to offer his analysis of current events and issues. On Thursday, it's Brian Albrecht's turn with his monthly visit to the program. Brian Albrecht, of course, is the president of Gateway Technical College. And this Friday, in honor of the play Lombardi, which just opened at the Racine Theater Guild, I'm going to be replaying my memorable interview with John Eisenberg, author of that first season, how Vince Lombardi took the worst team in the NFL and set it on the path to glory. The Green Bay Packers indeed were the worst team in professional football when Lombardi took them over. And the story of that first season is an incredible story. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. You will find the program archived on our website.